The alterations took only 2 days, and Kane, Grant, and Bridget stayed out of the way. The primary work involved reprogramming the mainframe with the logarithmic data copied from the interfacer's memory disk. A new dedicated control console was installed, and since it was built for function, it didn't conform to the streamlined symmetry of the rest of the equipment. It bristled with thousands of tiny electrodes and complexities of naked circuitry, leading to a switchboard containing relays and readout screens.
"It looks like something put together from odds and ends found in Tom Edison's basement."
Bry wasn't sure if his work was being praised or criticized. Lakish roughly sketched out his idea of a test probe. Rauch and Kata took his loose specs and built a small vid camera contrivance mounted within a shielded vanadium alloy shell. Bry doubted it would work.
"Even with the shielding, it'll be exposed to enough energy that the electronics in it will freeze up."
"On the contrary. During our initial experiments, Operation Kronos had sent remote vid probes down the timeline. They returned essentially intact."
"How many times do I have to tell you we're not doing the same things they were doing?"
Lakesh only smiled at him patronizingly. Early in the evening of the second day, Lakesh announced he was ready for the attempt to forge the Omega Path. He summoned Bridget, Kane, and Grant so they could witness failure or success, or something in between. Bry dourly noted everyone should be prepared for the former and consider themselves lucky if the latter happened. Although Lakesh was considerably stronger, his color better, he had conceded to DeFore's orders to confine his movements to the wheelchair. He sat in front of the new console, eyes alight with excitement and anticipation. Bridget wondered if he had looked and acted that way right before Project Cerberus made its first successful transport of organic matter.
"The main Matrans controls have been rerouted through this board. The unit's destination lock has been reset to focus not just on a point in space, but in time."
"Which is where and when?"
Lakesh shrugged, waving a dismissive hand.
"I can't be sure of either. The time lock is set for the turn of this century, with a factored-in leeway of 5 years. The destination lock is open, so the matter stream will home in on whatever gateway was functioning within this hemisphere 95 to 100 years ago.
"Give or take 5 years? Who would have been operating the Matrans network that long ago?"
"Perhaps no one. Or perhaps someone will receive quite the surprise."
Bry placed the vid probe in the center of the gateway chamber. It was a small dome sheathed in gray alloy. The tiny camera lens protruded from a round opening. A nearby monitor showed the clear image of brown-hued armaglass walls. Leaving the chamber, he stood by the door.
"Ready for the auto-sequence initiator."
"Button her up, Mr. Bry."
Bry stepped hastily back. Lakesh reached a hand to close switches on the board. Indicator lights flared brilliantly, registering full power. Dancing lines raced across readout screens. Bridget shifted her gaze back and forth from the probe's interior view displayed on the monitor to the outside of the chamber. On the vid screen, mist shot through with miniature lightning billowed up from the floor plates. Through the armaglass walls, light pulsed, flared, bloomed.
"The probe is away. To where and when, I do not know."
On the readout screens connected to the switchboard, sine and cosine waves stretched, pulsated, intertwined. Lakesh stared at them.
"Interference pattern!
The goddamn thing is still cycling! It should be shutting down!"
Grant, Bridget, and Kane went to the doorway of the anteroom. Crooked fingers of energy stabbed through the gateway chamber. They watched with awe and dread as thousands of crackling threads of light coalesced in the center of the unit.
"What's happening?"
Lakesh hunched over the board, sweat sheening his face.
I'm not sure. It's almost as if we've intercepted a stream of electrons. No, that can't be. That would mean someone or something is trying to dilate the temporal continuum from another Matrans unit. Whatever it is, it's coming into phase."
Gushing lines of energy formed a luminous cloud within the chamber. Almost faster than the eye could perceive, the cloud grew more dense and definite of outline. Through the walls, they vaguely discerned a human figure.
"It's cycling down, and there's somebody in there!"
"Somebody, maybe. We don't know who or what the hell it is."
Lakesh wheeled himself into the anteroom.
"If our matter stream transfer worked across the fourth dimension, our guest might be from another time plane. Bry, open the door."
"There's still a lot of wild energy in there."
"Do it, God damn you."
Bry wrenched the handle of the door with a convulsive movement. Bry trembled slightly, ready to slam it shut on its counterbalanced hinges. Everyone stiffened in amazement at the figure standing in the chamber. Because a faint halo surrounded him, like cobwebs spun of shimmering light, there was an unearthliness about him. A tall, lean man in a frayed black frock coat stood there, his long gray hair spilling past his shoulders. Cracked and scuffed riding boots rose to just below his knees. He held an ebony cane in both hands, clutching it to his chest. Light sparked from the silver, snarling lion's head topping it. The blue eyes in the lined face were alive with intelligence, and his slender frame somehow suggested an aristocratic nature, despite his unique, somewhat shabby clothing. Surveying the people standing in the anteroom, he grinned nervously, displaying excellent teeth.
By the three Kennedys! Something tells me I'm not in Omaha.
Lakesh wheeled himself closer to the chamber, pushing between Grant and Kane. The man took a cautious half-step back, twisting the lion's head on his cane. He pulled half a foot of glittering razored steel from the ebony sheath, a gesture more of warning than threat. The halo dancing around the man's body exuded curling, crackling strings of energy. He looked around swiftly, eyes showing fearful bewilderment.
It's cycling again. We've got to seal the chamber.
Lakesh hesitated, squinting as the shimmer around the man built to a blinding borealis.
We don't know the wavelength of that radiation. It could be fatal. Could contaminate the regatta if it's not contained.
Do it.
Almost immediately, a star seemed to go nova behind the armaglass, bringing a millisecond of eye-searing brilliance followed by a millisecond of utter silence. Stumbling back a pace, bumping into the table, Grant furiously knuckled his eyes.
Son of a bitch! What's going on?
When everyone's overstressed optic nerves recovered, they saw not even a dimmest candlelight flicker within the chamber.
Open it!
Blinking, Bry lifted up the handle, swinging the door open. The little vid remote squatted on a hexagon, wisps of vapor curling around its metal skin. Entering the chamber, Bry gingerly reached down for it.
Ah! Son of a...
Static buildup. To be expected.
Bry cast him another sour look and tentatively tapped the vanadium shell.
Huh. It's cool to the touch.
Bring it out, please.
That man who appeared in the chamber.
Yes?
You've read the Wyeth Codex, haven't you?
Of course. I was the one responsible for disseminating it through the historical divisions of the Vils. But, unlike you, I didn't memorize it.
The Wyeth Codex purported to be the journal of one Dr. Mildred Wyeth, a woman who had been in cryogenic suspension during the Nukecost. Revived a century later, she roamed Deathlands in the company of the legendary Ryan Cotter. She made a record of her wanderings, as well as her thoughts, observations, and speculations regarding the post-Skydark world. She was particularly suspicious of the redoubts and the totality concept. The manuscript had been found and secretly spread among the archivists of the Vil Network as an example of the kinds of truth the Barons wanted buried.
One of her companions was allegedly the only recorded success of Operation Kronos, a Dr. T.A. Tanner, trawled from the late 19th century.
Yes, of course. Now I remember. According to the Codex, his favorite expression was "by the three Kennedys," a particularly vacuous expletive in my opinion. But it's not possible we intercepted the Kronos matter stream. Tanner was trawled up the line in 1998. Our time lock was set for only 100 or so years ago.
After spending a couple of years in the 20th century, Tanner was bumped 100 years into the future. Maybe we intercepted that carrier wave.
Or perhaps Tanner stumbled over time dilation technology in some abandoned redoubt. Wasn't there a reference to an event like that in the Codex?
Brief and undetailed. Something relating to Kronos found in Puerto Rico. Wyeth really wasn't much for providing straight narratives.
Who cares? The only puzzle we should be trying to work out is if that thing can take us back in time.
Very true, friend Kane. Let's find out what sights our little probe recorded.
As it turned out, nothing but variegated streaks of light showed up on the tape, indicating exposure to high levels of electromagnetic radiation.
I figured as much.
Regardless of the video record, all our instruments showed we bridged the abyss between this temporal plane and another.
We don't know that for sure. We could have intercepted a carrier wave from another gateway unit.
Lakesh stabbed a finger toward the big Mercator relief map spanning the wall.
If that were the case, the origin point would be registered there. No, we did it all right.
What next? Send us back to January 19, 2001, to the Russian embassy?
No, that's not the way. Security would never let you pass the reception desk. Injecting any of you into the past strictly to undo what Colonel Thrush might have done is too risky on a number of counts.
I thought undoing is the whole point of the Omega Path.
Your thinking is correct, as far as it extends. But the ways of achieving an objective are many, and often they are found by traveling away from the objective. The next step in the process requires a great deal of contemplation and research. I'll let you know when I've reached a conclusion. Mr. Bry, remain here with me, please. There are technical matters to discuss.
Although annoyed about the abrupt dismissal, Grant, Bridget, and Kane were just as glad to be left out of a no-doubt heated exchange spoken in technobabble. Grant went to the dispensary to check on Domi. Bridget walked with Kane along the corridor as far as the elevator.
Are you headed for the cafeteria?
No.
Salvo?
Yes.
You finally decided to tell him what Lakesh told you. Do you think it'll make a damn bit of difference to him?
I couldn't say.
He may have been victimized by Lakesh's schemes, but he's way past the age of accountability for his own actions. Whether he let his father's anger and resentment poison his own life is immaterial. Whether you're his brother is irrelevant. He's a petty, sadistic, vicious, evil man. Revenge for you being born is his guiding passion.
Tell me something I don't know. But I thought you believed in redemption.
I don't know what gave you that impression. Just because I didn't care to watch you murder him in front of me doesn't mean I think there's anything worth salvaging there.
He stepped into the elevator, smiling wryly.
Maybe not. I'm new at this. I've never had a brother before.
Just your luck, it has to be him.
As the elevator dropped him to the third floor, he wondered why he hadn't told her about his dream, about what his father had said regarding the other. Kane realized it wasn't so much fear she wouldn't understand, but that she would. Mentally, he traced the sequence of events leading up to this moment. Due to a probability wave dysfunction, the world had been consumed by a nuclear firestorm. The program of unification had imposed the tyranny of the Barons. Lakesh had played God to create opposition. Salvo and Kane had been born, and Salvo hated Kane. And now Salvo waited in an underground padded cell for his brother to visit. Of course, Lakesh had not begun it. It was the Archons who were responsible. Though, as they'd discovered on their last mission, the origin of the Archons was itself a legitimate question. Why was it, Kane wondered, they never managed to lay their hands on the real culprits? The bottom level of Cerberus was some 150 feet below solid shielded rock. It held the nuclear generators, various maintenance and machine rooms, and the air conditioning core. A semi-detached wing contained 10 detention cubicles, all of them as nicely appointed as the average flat in the Cobaltville enclaves. Kane tapped in the sec code on the door leading to the wing. He walked through a dimly lit corridor that had once been bisected by a wire mesh security checkpoint, and then to Salvo's cell. He looked through the small ob slit. The walls and floor were covered by a thick, quilted padding. Water was provided by a soft rubber hose that protruded only half an inch from a socket in the wall. A rimmed depression in a corner served as a toilet. Salvo lay on his side, face turned toward the wall. A corner of a white bandage stood out brightly in the feeble light of the cubicle. He didn't move, but Kane saw the slow rise and fall of steady respiration. Salvo slowly roused as Kane stepped in, stiffly pushing himself to a sitting position. He wore one of the Cerberus standard-issue white bodysuits and a non-standard-issue plastic splint on his nose. Both of his eyes were slits surrounded by swollen bruises. His puffy, discolored lauer lip showed the 6 stitches Auerbach had sewn in it. A purple, banana-shaped swelling, partly covered by the bandage, ran the width of his forehead. Although his dentures had been returned to him, he still looked worse than Lakesh had only a few days before. Kane leaned against the door,
Nice place, isn't it? Better than the cells on C or E level.
Yeah. How long have I been down here?
About 52 hours, give or take a couple of minutes.
What do you want?
To talk to you. Lakesh told me about me and you and how we were born. He was responsible for it, you know.
Dad never said who it was. Just that he was high in the Baron's favor. Deep down, I guess I always suspected that bastard was behind it.
Yeah, deep down. Why did you do it?
Do what?
Keep this from me, for all these years. Punish me for something neither one of us could help.
You were supposed to be better than me. Smarter, stronger, more adaptable.
And better looking, too. So?
So you're not. I set out to prove that you weren't.
Prove to whom?
Me, you dumb shit. To my dad, and to you.
Pretty one-sided competition, since you didn't let me know I was on the playing field.
Salvo spread his hands in an expansive gesture.
Hey, I didn't say it was fair. That was the beauty of it, Kane. I turned and twisted and double-screwed you so many times, and you never knew why.
Why did you recruit me into the Trust?
The temptation to assign you every filthy, soul-breaking job I could think of was too much to let pass, I guess.
You guess? I don't believe you, Salvo. You probably don't know yourself.
And you do?
I can make a pretty good guess. You hated me, but you couldn't live without me. If you'd actually just wanted me dead, you could have figured out how to do that many times over the years.
Salvo didn't react. He sat and stared unblinkingly. Kane's smile broadened, showing an edge of teeth.
The truth you could never accept is that you need me. The true target of all your hatred is fate, for having made you such a buggering monster of a man. But you couldn't punish fate. You could only punish me. And if you chilled me, you could no longer punish me. And then you'd be alone with that big, empty hole inside of you, with nothing left to fill it.
Salvo blinked, casting his eyes floorward.
You're full of shit, Kane. You don't know anything.
Maybe not, but I know this. You're the one who begged me to chill you. You're the one in a cell. You're the one sitting there with a face I gave you, a face not even our father could love. So tell me, Salvo, who won the competition without even trying?
Salvo clenched his hands, the knuckles standing out like ivory knobs, tendons popping. He just stared at Kane, hating him, needing him, hating himself because he needed him.
You tell me something, Kane. If you have all the answers, why did you flush your whole life because of that woman?
Baptiste?
Yeah, the preservationist bitch. As an agent of the Trust, you could have had any woman you wanted, all the women you wanted. Why her?
Kane suddenly felt on the defensive and he didn't like it.
In the first place, since there are not and never have been any preservationists, she isn't one of them.
What? How can that be?
Lakesh made them up, so the Mags and the Barons would have some enemy to chase after and divert attention from what he was really up to.
Do you know how many confessions I got from preservationists? At least 100.
After you tortured them, sure, they'd confess to being anything you wanted them to be. But they weren't preservationists.
Well, this place... It has to be
the former seat of Project Cerberus, not the headquarters of the preservationists. Now it's a sanctuary.
Salvo's eyes couldn't widen very far, but they shone with disbelief. His entire world was being dismantled piece by piece until he had nothing left but his hatred, and even that was proving to have little foundation.
In the second place, I didn't flush my life for Baptiste.
The hell you didn't. She was nobody, Kane. A key-puncher. What hold does she have over you? You lost everything because you couldn't get that dumb bitch out of your guts.
Kane managed to control the sudden hot flush of anger.
You got me involved in shit, Salvo. And I got her involved, too. I had to uninvolve her.
You can't say I didn't try to uninvolve her, too, you know.
You tried to have her executed.
I did that for you, Kane. She had to die to protect the secrets and to protect you.
Why did you figure Grant had to die? I know you tried to have him chilled.
Stay on the subject. Why her?
Because I know her.
You never met her until the night before I arrested her.
Because I need her. I need her like you needed me. But the difference is, I trust her.
You're fused out, Kane. Over a woman. I never thought to see it.
Her name's Baptiste. I've had my say and my fill of you.
What are you gonna do with me?
I haven't made up my mind. I sure as hell don't want you, and I sure as hell don't need you. If I don't end up chilling you, Domi will find a way, when she's up and around.
I'm not afraid of an outland slut.
Too bad. You should be. Are you worth the effort, Selvo?
What effort?
To redeem you.
How can I answer that?
You may have to answer it before long. Cerberus doesn't need to strain its resources supporting two prisoners.
Are you making me an offer to join you?
Like I said, Cerberus is a sanctuary. All of us here are survivors of some tragedy. In your case, it's being born.
I'm a magistrate. I took an oath. I have my pride.
I'm sick of ideology, Selvo. It never seemed to work for me, only for you. The Barons and the Archons watched us crawl around the Outlands, the Hell Zones, chilling our fellow humans like gardeners ripping up weeds. Then they planted their own crop, laughing at our stupidity because we were sowing the seeds of our extinction. Your magistrate's oath and your magistrate's pride were taken away from you, just like they were taken away from me. They don't belong to either of us anymore.
He touched his forehead and his chest.
This and this are the only things that still belong to us, and the Archons tried to corrupt them too. When they hurt because of conscience or compassion, we were told we deserved the pain. I'm telling you that we don't deserve it, that we don't have to buy into that bullshit now. That's your chance of redemption, Selvo. I'd take advantage of it if I were you.
The next morning, Lakesh smiled from the vidscreen.
Greetings, Mohandas Lakesh Singh. Greetings from the future. I should wish you a happy new year, but I know in advance it won't be, so I shan't waste my time with social hypocrisy. By my calendar, old style, it is 2198 AD, a shade under 200 years since Armageddon. You know it's on its way. In fact, you know it's a little less than 3 weeks down the road. You think there is nothing you can do about it, so you have been desperately trying to convince yourself it's for the best. You know damn well you're lying to yourself. Who better to know this than me, since I am you and you are me?
Hold on. Stop the tape.
Lakesh's image froze on the screen in an unflattering pose, eyes half closed, lips stretched in a foolish smile. Lakesh sat in the same chair at the same desk as that displayed on the screen. Grant, Bridget, and Kane faced him across that desk, in his small, sparsely furnished office. Besides the desk and chairs, the only other piece of furniture was a small computer console. Lakesh's head and shoulders filled the screen.
What is this supposed to be?
In my search for the right place, in the right time, to inject history-altering elements, I considered several people who were instrumental in bringing about our present. Brilliant people who dealt with hitherto unknown scientific laws and who would understand a message from the future. Einstein was one. Clark Savage, Niels Bohr, and Torrance Silas Burr were the other candidates. Finally, I settled on myself.
You? That's ridiculous.
No, quite the contrary. It makes perfect sense.
Who better to convince myself that I'm making a horrific mistake than myself? Someone who was in the position to know the nature of the totality concept projects and their terribly destructive results. If I don't find myself credible, then no one else will either.
So to do this, you made a little home vid of yourself yapping away about how bad everything is 200 years later?
I was up all night putting this together. I edited in scenes from the vid library here, security tapes made in the anthill, made here in Cerberus right after the nuke. I provided a sufficiently visual counterpart to my verbal contentions. Do you want to see it or not?
Yeah. Sure.
The video continued. They were not prepared for the scenes of horror that began flashing across the screen, some of them so repulsive that even Kane and Grant were shaken. Bodies with the flesh seared down to the bone, people dying of fallout contamination, screaming to the videographers for help, blue-sheened intestines burst and lying on the ground, cities completely consumed by mile-high flame columns, roaring white-hot fires that covered thousands of acres. The images of atrocities seemed to go on and on, given a ghastly fillip by Lakesh's calm narration, his delivery as flat as if he were describing a house painting contest. Finally, Lakesh turned it off.
At the end of the recording, I offered a most convincing bit of evidence, myself, discussing highly personal incidents that I never spoke of with anyone. I put this vid together in order to shock, not to win an Oscar for Best Documentary.
None of them knew who Oscar was, and they weren't particularly interested at the moment.
How do you plan to get this message to yourself?
Yeah, you claimed you spent nearly 30 years in the Dulce installation, then a couple here, then a century frozen in the Anthill complex. Breaking into the Russian embassy to defuse an A-bomb seems a hell of a lot easier than trying to penetrate those places.
Indeed, yes. They probably would be. However, there was a 24-hour period when I was not in any of those places. From around noon, December 31st, 2000, to mid-morning of January 1st, 2001.
Where were you?
The Big Apple, New York City. I and three other Totality Concept Project overseers were brought to Manhattan to ring in the new millennium. Though we were accompanied by security warders, people could have gotten to us if they were determined enough.
And you intend to confront yourself?
No. I can't risk a causal paradox. Suppose I go back to Manhattan and am run down by a taxicab or shot by a mugger or even by my own bodyguards.
What would happen?
That's the problem and the paradox. I simply don't know. The principle of causality states that causes must precede effects. If my present self is killed in the past, would I even be born? Would we then have an effect without a cause?
Here we go. Just tell us what you have planned, all right?
Lakesh looked at Kane reproachfully, as if he resented being rudely cut off just as he was getting to the interesting part.
As you wish, friend Kane. Here is what I have planned. My trip to New York wasn't simply a vacation. I toured the Mattrans installations in the region. There were three. A redoubt upstate in the Adirondacks, a unit in the South Bronx, and one in Manhattan itself, beneath the so-called Twin Towers.
Twin Towers?
The World Trade Center. That unit was the smallest and newest of the three, the easiest to install due to construction work being done to repair terrorist bomb damage. Inasmuch as it was not a redoubt like the other two, security was lax. The procedures were designed to prevent people from entering it, not leaving it. I'll provide you with a detailed floor plan, a briefing jacket on the political, socioeconomic, and cultural conditions of the time, and my itinerary. I suggest, however, the best time to reach me and give me the vid disc is when I'm in the theater.
What theater?
New York City Center. We went to see a revival of Guys and Dolls, a famous musical based on a book by Damon Runyon. It was the first and only time I ever saw a Broadway show.
Let me make sure I understand. You're suggesting you transport us to the very tail end of the 20th century, to New York, to track down your younger self and somehow slip him, you, a vid disc?
Not somehow. Effectively is the word.
Kane began to feel the inner keenness, the anticipatory tingle of nerves that a challenge always kindled.
I'll supply you with everything you need. Money, appropriate clothes, identification. I presume all of you will want to embark on this mission.
Neither Grant, Kane, nor Bridget said anything in response.
Your silence gives your assent. Since I have some last-minute checking of calculations to perform, I will ask you to...
Let's not jump to conclusions.
Friend Kane, I thought you were the most anxious to participate in this undertaking.
I am, but there's no need for all three of us to be at risk.
Bridget shot him an icy green glare.
You're not cutting me out of this one, Kane. With my historical knowledge, I'm more qualified than you are.
I won't argue with you about that, even though I could. No, you're definitely a part of the jump team. But I'd feel better if Grant sat this one out.
just the two of you?
I didn't say that. We'll recruit a third member.
Like who? Bri? He's technically adept, but he's an academic. DeFore can't go because she's needed to perform Domi's surgery. That leaves personnel who wouldn't know one end of a blaster from another.
Except for one. Salvo.
What's wrong with you? 3 days ago, you nearly beat the bastard to death. He hates us both. We can never turn our backs on him.
It's the most fucked up, fused out idea you've ever had, Kane, and you've had a lot of them. You can't trust him. He'll sell you out or betray you at the first opportunity.
It's mad, hopelessly, stupendously unworkable. You're frightfully underestimating the risk of this proposal.
What should we do with him, then? Keep him here indefinitely? A permanent prisoner like Balaam, in the off chance he'll one day be of some use? Do we let Domi loose on him while we all watch? Take him outside and drop him off the cliff, time how long it takes him to hit bottom? Or do we give him the chance to come to terms with himself, with what he's been and what he's done? Namely, the same chance that Grant and I had.
The doctrine of redemption. You surprise me, Kane. Admirable sentiments, but this is not the mission on which to test them. This very well could be a one-way trip.
All the more reason not to put all three of us on the firing line. My way, at least, you'll still have Grant as your enforcement arm, and you'll be solving the Salvo problem at the same time.
Out of the question. Taking Salvo with us increases the risk factor exponentially.
In more ways than one. You'll be traveling back in the temporal stream to a pivotal point in history. Taking the wrong action at the wrong moment could create a new branching probability.
Isn't that what you wanted?
Lakesh pursed his lips and stared at Kane for a long moment.
I want to set in motion an alternate event horizon without violating the principle of causality. One already occurred due to Operation Kronos. My plan is to repair the dysfunction, not trigger another, which may have no bearing on this present. Conversely, something may happen that will trap the world in a catastrophe that can turn out to be 10 times worse than the nuke cost.
A spatial discontinuity? That's what Strongbow's singularity could have triggered.
Worse?
You formulate the plan, Lakesh. I'll see to it Salvo abides by it. This is his one chance. If he blows it, or if I simply don't like his attitude, I'll have no compunction about chilling him in his tracks.
That's quite the endorsement for somebody's behavior. But I guess, considering who it is, it's the best we can hope for.
Time stopped with a painful, choking wrench. Kane felt himself sinking into whirlpools of dark energy that sucked his blood and bones and soul out through the flesh and blew them in hurricane clouds through eternity. He spiraled up, then down, through every moment of his life, circling the moment of his birth, slingshotting around the first girl he ever kissed, the first life he ever took. He hung in the balance between present and past, shuddering on a thin thread as fragile as the memory of a half-forgotten dream. The thread slowly unraveled, twisting itself undone, looping and unlooping, then tying itself into knots of existence. He fell through a sea of images, and no matter how hard he tried to hang on to one thread of existence, it twisted through new ones and slipped away from him in the whirling currents. He thrashed and kicked, but touched nothing. Then came again a sharp, wrenching, dislocating shock that he felt through every fiber, every cell, every follicle. Time started again. Kane dimly realized his sensations were again those of the physical. As he understood it, he felt pain crowding through his body. His breath had to be drawn in stages because of the nausea floating high in his throat. His head felt all out of proportion, a mass of hollow pain that had no clearly defined borders. He wanted to sleep, but instead he doubled over in a retching spasm. He hadn't eaten anything for the 12 hours preceding walking into the gateway, so his stomach had nothing to empty. Tears filled his eyes. Slowly, Kane's nausea ebbed, and he stopped trying to heave up the lining of his stomach. He swiped a coat sleeve over his face, blinked blearily around, and his whole body jerked upright. Through the transparent armor glass, he saw a small chamber with a control console running the length of the north wall. To his left, a 2-yard-high passage, walled with clean, softly gleaming metal, led straight ahead. Kane stood up, staggering dizzily across the metal floor of the chamber to the door. The glowing LCD indicated no movement within sensor range. Brigid unsteadily rose to her feet.
How do you feel?
Awfully dizzy. My stomach's on fire, too.
If it's any consolation, you look good.
It's not. I feel ridiculous.
Brigid's usually unkempt mane of hair had been elaborately coiffed and crimped, using a 200-year-old pix of a fashion model as a guide. Her tresses caught the indirect light and reflected strands of gold. Her lips were rouged, her cheekbones highlighted. The mascara on green eyes shone brightly behind the round, lightly tinted lenses of rimless spectacles. Though the charcoal-colored two-piece tweed suit she wore was sensible enough, the skirt was very short and tight. Her long legs, encased in black tights, were shown to full advantage, with black boots laced up to mid-calf. She draped a dark gray overcoat over an arm and held a rakishly brimmed fedora in one hand. The bulge made by the Beretta 93R in cross-draw slide holster above her left hip was barely discernible. Equally well hidden was the vid disc, resting in a hidden, zippered pocket inside of her coat. Cerberus contained a small collection of 20th-century artifacts, though certainly not as extensive or as varied as that stored in the Historical Division of Cobaltville. Part of the collection featured articles of clothing, and with a few alterations, Brigid, Kane, and Salvo had been properly attired in the fashion of the day. Kane and Salvo wore similar black overcoats, slacks, and sports jackets over dark turtlenecks. Kane wished he had his Kevlar weave mag greatcoat, but he had been forced to discard it during the Irish op. The right sleeve of his coat had been restitched to accommodate the holstered Sin Eater. Salvo stirred. Kane didn't help him. The man no longer wore the nose splint, but the bruised flesh around his eyes was concealed by a pair of dark glasses. During preparation for the jump, Lakesh had talked for so long about separate temporal arteries and other topics that seemed so esoteric and irrelevant to the mission that Kane had accused him of trying to make them too nervous to even sneeze in the 20th century. Lakesh had instantly pounced on the sarcastic observation, spinning out an appalling scenario of them infecting an entire community with microbes to which they were immune, but could be deadly to anyone not born in post-Skydark America. As it was, an hour before the jump, they had been forced to undergo an extremely thorough decontamination process where everything but their thoughts was sterilized. Salvo finally pushed himself to his feet.
Did we make it? Are we here?
We're somewhere. We're not in Cerberus at any rate. It's too soon to tell if we're in another time, as well as another place.
Let's find out.
She made a point of stepping wide around Salvo, not completely turning her back to him. Kane tried to make eye contact with Salvo, but he evaded his gaze. Convincing the man to join the team hadn't required a great deal of persuasion, since Kane had let him know the alternative was a quick demise. Even the prospect of being in close contact with Baptiste hadn't appeared to color his decision. In fact, he had been civil to her before the jump, if not exactly courteous. Of course, the prospect of another brutal beating if he spoke to her disrespectfully more than likely motivated his rare display of tolerable manners. Kane had briefed Salvo on the mission, its objectives, and its dangers. He hoped to reach some small kernel of decency buried within the man, so he would want the chance to put matters right. Kane had no idea if he reached that kernel or not. He assumed Salvo was cooperating out of the oldest of human drives, fear for his own life. Kane understood that, but he had no patience with it. When he reached for the door handle, his own fear hit him, suddenly and unexpectedly. The resolve that had pushed him to insist on the mission vanished. An icy flood of fear ran through him. His hand gripped the metal handle tightly, but he didn't make a move. A tidal wave of uncertainty crashed over him, abrading his nerve endings.
This is crazy. What are we doing? We can't time travel. We can't change history.
Brigid moved to his side, putting a hand to rest on his shoulder.
It's all right.
He brushed her hand away, but she replaced it firmly.
The fear has hit you, that's all.
I'm never afraid. I can't be afraid.
Of course you can. I'm afraid too. Together, we'll master it. We'll put the fear behind us and walk out and do what needs to be done, like we always do. Remember who you are, the man who always beats the odds. 1%, remember?
With an effort of will, he forced the strength back into himself.
You're right.
I usually am. That's why you can barely stand me.
Ever the point man, Kane stepped out into dim, suffused light. The overhead light strips produced enough illumination for him to find his way easily. Salvo came last, moving very cautiously. He met Kane's eye, then looked hastily away. Kane wondered what he had thought of the scene between him and Baptiste. He was probably bemused and disgusted, though pleased to see the vulnerability in his brother. Once again, Kane was glad he hadn't permitted Salvo to carry weapons. Kane followed the straight line of the corridor. It went on for 100 feet, then reached a junction point, 4 passages radiating off like the spokes of a wheel. At the mouth of each corridor, numbers 1 through 4 were on the floor in red paint. Kane stood in the hub.
Sensors are clean. No one's about. This is a different layout than other redoubts we've been to.
It's not a redoubt, exactly. It's like a rat's maze.
What would rats do? Hey, Salvo, that's something you should know.
Salvo only scowled at the floor, hands tucked in the pockets of his coat.
Best as I recall, rats habitually choose a right-hand path.
They chose the one to their far right. The corridor was much shorter than the one that led from the Mattrans unit. Beyond a doorless square lay a reception room furnished with armchairs, a couch, a low table scattered with magazines, and a coffee machine. A television set supported by a metal framework was positioned in a corner just below the ceiling. A double set of doors marked an elevator shaft.
No guards.
If we're where and when we're supposed to be, then it's a holiday. Since this little installation doesn't have much strategic importance to the totality concept, all the personnel were probably given the night off.
It doesn't make sense there wouldn't be any security.
This isn't Cobaltville.
Though he begrudged it, Kane found he couldn't disagree with Salvo. His point man's sixth sense rang an alert. The atmosphere of the place had subtly changed somehow. Kane pivoted on his heel. Gliding into the room only inches beneath the light strip came a 2-foot-long segmented object that looked like an insect made of burnished steel. A photoelectric cell glowed dull red where the eye should have been. Fringing the edges of the metal carapace were rows of flexible pincer-like extruders. They clicked open and shut on tiny joints. The thing reached a point above them, hovering. Its eye rotated rapidly in the socket.
Tracking device. It's probably transmitting what it sees to a closed-circuit vid somewhere.
Lockish didn't say anything about that.
He told me similar machines were used in the Anthill complex.
Can it hurt us?
Unlikely. It's been designed primarily for surveillance.
As soon as she finished speaking, the bug hurtled straight down at her head. She dodged nimbly to one side, and it landed on her left arm, the tiny pincers gripping the sleeve tightly. Bridget convulsed, limbs flailing. She staggered the length of the room, falling against the wall. Kane realized the device was administering electric voltage, trying to shock her into unconsciousness.
Baptiste!
With a single bound, he reached her side, leveling the sin-eater at the thing clinging to her arm. Fragments of it spun away in a brief, blinding shower of sparks. Bridget leaned against the wall, vigorously rubbing feeling back into her arm. The elevator doors slid apart as soon as Salvo came within a foot of them.
I'm okay.
Usually right, huh?
I stand corrected. Let's get out of here before more of those things show up.
The car was large, with polished brass handrails. There were no buttons on the exterior. The elevator rose swiftly and smoothly, but only for a handful of seconds. They stared into a large, square room. The floor was thickly carpeted in a muted shade of rose red. The walls were marbled, a black speckled white in color. Paintings of abstract design hung on the walls. 4 high-backed leather-upholstered chairs were arranged around a varnished table. They faced a long, broad, mahogany desk with 2 tall vases full of flowers at both ends. Hanging on the wall above it was an ornate, gilt-faced clock. The hands read 6:45. On the right side of the room, a hallway stretched away, lined on both sides with wooden doors. On their left, they saw a glass and chrome door. Kane crept out of the elevator, sweeping the motion detector back and forth in one hand, his sin-eater firmly gripped in the other. Bridget and Salvo followed him cautiously as he walked, heel to toe, across the lobby to the broad desk. Behind it stood a swivel chair, positioned inside the curving sweep of a horseshoe-shaped console. Five small vid monitors glowed on it, showing uninteresting black-and-white images of bare, shadowy rooms. The sixth screen displayed, playing it over and over, a high-angle view of the three of them, staring upward. The sequence ended with a blurry shot of Bridget and then dissolved in a pattern of pixelated snow.
You were right about the closed circuit, at least, Baptiste. The bug transmitted what went on to a receiver up here.
Well, somebody should have seen it then. All sorts of alarms should have gone off. Where's the guard on duty?
On the LCD, a small dot pulsed far in its right-hand corner. Kane turned the knob on the monitor screen to blank out the incriminating vid images and turned in the direction of the hallway. Kane remained beside the desk, leaning his left elbow casually atop it, hiding his blaster in the folds of his coat. A young, slender man with dusky Latino features sauntered down the stretch of corridor. He wore a starched pale blue uniform with a badge pinned to the shirt front and insignia patches sewn onto the sleeves. Kane appraised his movements, judging that it would take him a fatally long time to draw the Colt Python revolver snugged in the black plastic holster at his hip. The guard was so occupied with his zipper, he didn't notice Kane until he was nearly to the end of his desk. The young man's gait faltered, his black eyes widening as he took in the three strangers standing in a place they had no business standing. Before he could recover sufficiently from his surprise to voice demands, Kane slipped his hand into an inner pocket of his coat, came out with a little wallet, and flipped it open in a practiced authoritarian motion. The guard saw the logo and credentials of a Defense Intelligence Agency operative.
DIA.
Kane glanced at the young man's name tag pinned to his shirt pocket.
Why weren't you at your post, Hector?
I had to go to the head, sir.
You're the only man on duty tonight?
Yes, sir. See, I'm the newest, so
Has the Dulce Scientific Envoy made their inspection yet?
Oh, yes, sir. Hours ago, sir.
Kane replaced his identification in his pocket.
Just making sure they're sticking to their schedule. Stand easy, son. We're not here to inspect you.
The guard smiled uneasily and went to his chair behind the desk. He frowned slightly when he noticed one of the monitors was dark.
Buzz us out, please.
Yes, sir.
Kane turned to the left, striding purposefully toward the glass and chrome door. He didn't look behind him to see if Salvo and Bridget were following. He was too busy hoping Hector wouldn't inquire as to how they got into the office.
Sir?
Kane didn't perceptibly tense, but he lightly rested his index finger on the trigger of the sin-eater. He turned slightly, Bridget and Salvo moving carefully to either side to give him a clear fire zone.
Yes?
Happy New Year.
Same to you, son.
Kane stepped into the subterranean parking garage Lakesh had told them about. The air was very cool and held an oily scent. Kane allowed Bridget to take the lead, since she had memorized the floor plan Lakesh had sketched out. He resisted the impulse to give the variety of vehicles lining their route more than a cursory glance. Just in case spy eyes observed them, he didn't want to present the impression of a man who had never seen so many wags before, which of course he was. Bridget guided them to wide concrete steps reaching upward. Painted on the wall beside them were the words, "Exit to street level." They climbed the stairs, the temperature dropping from cool to cold, the smells becoming stronger, stranger, and unpleasant. They climbed out onto the paved floor of a darkened, hedge-enclosed courtyard between two mind-staggeringly huge structures. Their sheer walls rose above the courtyard for hundreds of feet. Visible overhead between them was an oddly blurred square of indigo sky. Kane momentarily forgot his tension, awed by the time and effort and expense it must have taken to create such towering monuments. They breathed shallowly against the exhaust fumes produced by the stream of traffic.
New York, New York.
Yeah, the hell of a town.
Crowds of people, laughing, talking, arguing, cursing, flowed past in a never-ending stream. The lighting adorning shop fronts was a blinking, multicolored kaleidoscope against the man-made canyons that rose to block out the sky. There were more people than Bridget, Salvo, or Kane had ever seen in one place. Even the seething alleys and lanes of the Tartarus pits held only 1,000 people, and it seemed like twice that many tramped past the dimly lit courtyard in the few minutes they stood there. A couple of months earlier, Kane, Grant, and Bridget had visited Moscow, and the sheer volume and diversity of humanity there had been unsettling. But post-Skydark Moscow was a sleepy country ville compared to pre-nuke Manhattan. Lakesh had told them approximately 10 million people occupied the 5 boroughs comprising Greater New York City. At a conservative estimate, that was twice the population of the entire continental United States.
Smell that stench! This is what you want to save?
Shut up. Baptiste, you know the way to the theater.
I memorized the route. Lakesh said it wasn't a good idea to stand around looking at maps. We could be mugged.
Mugged?
Slagjacked.
We've a few hours yet before Lakesh is due to arrive. I guess we should get a look at the place.
She started off across the courtyard toward the sidewalk. As Kane followed her, he had a new attack of serious second thoughts. The notion of joining the mass of humanity milling on the street made him distinctly uncomfortable. What if they were mugged? What if something completely unforeseen happened, trapping them in the past, only 21 days away from doomsday? With every step he took, his stomach somersaulted. Then they joined the throng on the sidewalk, and were jostled, bumped, shouldered aside, and ignored as if they were invisible. Kane didn't like it one bit, and he saw by Salvo's bunched jaw muscles, he liked it even less. As magistrates, they were accustomed to their badges and armor parting a crowd like the prow of a ship parts the sea. Lesser breeds scrambled out of their path. They wouldn't even dream of blocking it. Bridget walked, or tried to, swiftly and purposefully. Never in their lives had they imagined such a numerous, eclectic morass of humanity. Though Lakesh had briefed them on what to expect, even showed them old vids of New York, the sensory input was almost overwhelming. It was stinking, overcrowded turmoil. They passed a preponderance of electronics shops, pizzerias, discount bookstores, and cut-rate jewelry stores. Many of the windows were plastered with signs proclaiming New Year's Eve specials and one-time-only millennium sale, everything must go. Every few feet, street vendors waved wristwatches, trinkets, sweaters, or fireworks. The smell of baked bread drifting from pretzel stands sharply reminded Kane how long it had been since he'd eaten. It was a curious tension in the air, and Kane tried to pin down its exact nature. He caught bits and pieces of conversation, some spoken in accents he could not identify or barely comprehend. He overheard references to money, to children, to movies, to New Year's resolutions. Twice, he heard fearful mumbles about Judgment Day and the imminent end of the world.
Baptiste, some of these people know what's going to happen.
What do you mean?
I've overheard them talking about Judgment Day. They know.
They don't know. Not really. I read about this.
Read about what?
It's a cultural phenomenon called Millennium Fever. About 5 or 6 years ago, counting backward from 2000, when the end of the century was approaching, a form of hysteria about the new millennium manifested. First, it was only religious types warning about the end of the world. Then it filtered down into the public consciousness. That's what they were talking about. They really don't know what's going to happen. They're just afraid that something will.
Kane wasn't reassured. Ahead, flashing red and blue lights lined both sides of an intersection. There appeared to have been a minor vehicle accident. He glanced back at Salvo. The man stared fixedly at the lights and commotion and didn't see the girl until she bumped into him. Kane was sure it had been intentional, so he slowed, then stopped. The girl had long blonde hair and a face so thickly caked with cosmetics she looked like an evil doll. She blocked Salvo's way with the provocative thrust of her breasts against the knit fabric of a form-fitting blouse.
Hey, baby! You want to ring in the new year with me? I could pop your cork real good.
Salvo glanced down at her with contempt and made a move to step around her.
I doubt it.
Kane watched, amused, then became aware that the girl wasn't really looking at Salvo, but over his shoulder. Kane's sixth sense warned him, and he took a quick long step forward. He saw the glint of light on steel even before he fully noted the scrawny black man standing behind Salvo. He took in a breath to call out a warning, but it was unnecessary. Salvo acted instinctively, lunging to one side and kicking out with his right foot, catching the man on the sensitive inside of his left thigh. The leg buckled, and Salvo's knotted fist swung around in a backward arc, thudding into the man's forehead, sending him staggering. He would have fallen if not for a lamppost at his back. The girl clawed for Salvo, but Kane caught her by the hair, wrenching her backward. She dove through the crowd and disappeared, leaving Kane with a blonde wig in his fist. Salvo turned to face his assailant, but the man made a staggering lunge off the curb and into the stream of traffic. He dodged, weaved, leaped, and hopped with a skill obviously born of long experience. Reaching the opposite side of the boulevard, he disappeared into the dark mouth of an alley. The crowd had paused only for a moment, murmuring about crack whores, then went on their way, not wanting to know anything more about the incident than they had already seen. The knife still glittered on the sidewalk. Salvo bent down and picked it up.
Slaggers assaulting citizens. Kane, you expect me to believe a world like this is better than the one we have?
Kane dropped the wig, not responding to Salvo's questions. Slaggers were confined to the Tartarus pits, where they could prey on one another without fear of official reprisal. However, they could not prey on the citizenry who lived in the enclaves because they weren't allowed near them, except in the most menial, service-oriented manner. Secondly, if a citizen was ever assaulted by a slagger, retaliatory action undertaken by the mags would be bloody and brutal and out of all reasonable proportion to the original transgression. That policy of overkill had prevented a major pit uprising for over a generation. The last one had claimed the lives of Kane's and Salvo's grandfathers.
Lose the sticker and let's go.
Reflectively, Salvo tested with a thumb the razor-sharp blade. Then, with a snapping motion of his arm, he tossed the knife toward the scummy water flowing sluggishly in the gutter. Brigid had stepped out of the crowd during the brief struggle, leaning against the plate glass display window of an electronics store. A dozen television sets, stacked in a ziggurat shape, flashed the same vivid color image of a youngish, well-dressed man with salt-and-pepper hair.
That was stupid. What if you'd chilled him or caused him to be run down by a wag?
What if I had? No loss?
How do you know his son or grandson might not be a great scientist or even president? You could have changed history, you simple bastard.
Kane glanced at the multiple images of the man on the television sets. He read the caption superimposed over the bottom edge of the screen. For a long moment, he stared uncomprehendingly at the words.
President? This isn't right.
Brigid eyed him with irritation, followed his gaze, and turned around to look at the televisions. After a few seconds, she gaped too for a very long time, straining to hear what the man identified as the President of the United States was saying. She blinked, swung her head toward Kane, the dazed, stricken expression on her blood-drained face perfectly matching his own.
That's not the right president.
Salvo flicked his dark-lensed eyes back and forth between Kane, Brigid, and the images on the television screens.
What are you talking about?
Brigid leaned a shoulder against the window, as if all her strength were seeping out through the soles of her feet. She put a hand to her forehead.
Did Lakesh fuck up? Did he send us to the wrong time?
No, we're in the right time and place. New York City, December 31st, 2000.
Kane jabbed an arm toward the televisions.
Then who's that guy? Lakesh showed us pics of who the president was supposed to be, and that's not him.
Brigid bowed her head.
The scattered threads of time have been sewn together in a Gordian knot. Time squared.
Cut out the bullshit! Did we or did we not travel back to the right time?
We did. Right time, right place. Wrong universe.
Lakesh had told them about the way it was. In 1988, President Ronald Reagan was succeeded by his vice president. A crisis in Latin America had grown into a prolonged shooting war during Reagan's two terms in office, as the Soviet Union and United States supplied the opposing factions with weapons and funds. Reagan's successor faced the Russian leader, Mikhail Gorbachev, across a bargaining table in Geneva so that their respective governments could step back from the brink of outright hostilities with as much grace as could be mustered. Despite this foreign relations victory, the president was not voted back in for a second term. In 1992, the U.S. electorate put in office an aging Democrat, a longtime politician from a dynasty of politicians. This new Democratic president made a series of diplomatic blunders during his 4 years as leader of the United States, some of them verging on the disastrous. In 1996, the previous Republican president was returned to office in a thundering landslide victory, and became, for only the second time in American history, an ousted president who returned in triumph to the White House. But this had a negligible effect on the increasingly hostile relations between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. Gorbachev had died in 1993, and for 6 months thereafter, Russia was racked by a civil war. The man who tried to bring a degree of order out of his country's chaos was the new premier, Ryzhkov. Still, America and Russia exchanged more threats than promises of goodwill over bargaining tables, especially after Fidel Castro was murdered in 1993. The sphere of old-style communism was definitely shrinking around the planet. Toward the end of the president's term, in the spring of 1999, there occurred an event that led directly to the nuclear holocaust. In a spectacular coup, Ryzhkov was assassinated in the corridors of the Kremlin by hardline Stalinist revisionists. The coup had been masterminded by the head of the KGB, V.N. Prittish. He believed the way to restore his country's former glories was to revive the brutal yet efficient methods of Joseph Stalin. Unbeknownst to even Prittish, a fanatical group of disaffected internal security officers, calling themselves the Vezezozhenye, or Terrible Fire, had determined to redress what they perceived as humiliations heaped upon Russian pride. To this end, they saw to the planting of 3 nuclear warheads in and around Washington, D.C. They timed the detonations, with an ugly sense of irony, for Presidential Inauguration Day. Less than a minute after the first mushroom cloud appeared over the District of Columbia, Air Force General P.X. Fragg Fredrickson keyed in the proper sequence to launch a retaliatory strike at Russia. Within the next hour, World War III began and ended. No one knew who had won or lost the war because no government statisticians remained to conduct body counts. Conservative estimates calculated that over 2/3 of the Earth's population perished during those first 2 hours and 45 minutes. Since, by then, the entire planet was a smoldering cinder, there was no sure way of differentiating between the victors and the vanquished. Sometime late that afternoon, the nuclear winter, or the sky dark, began. Massive quantities of pulverized rubble had been propelled into the atmosphere, clogging the sky for a generation, blanketing the entire planet in a thick cloud of radioactive dust, ash, debris, smoke, and fallout. After 25 years of endless nights, of freezing temperatures even in subtropical climates, of fallout storms, millions more had perished. When the survivors and the children born after the nuke cost climbed out of their shelters, their bunkers, their caves, they knew only one dream: to survive. The old cultures were gone, burned down to their foundations. New societies were formed, with their own laws, their own rules, their own beliefs, and even their own dialects. These only dimly reflected the changes of the planet itself. Most of North America was known as the Deathlands, an aptly named home to mutated forms of animal, vegetable, and human life, radioactive hotspots, marauders, and scattered settlements of people trying to scratch out an existence in a hostile environment. Human culture in the seething hell zones of the Deathlands existed at its lowest level since the Dark Ages. The people were divided into hundreds of restless tribes, warring among themselves, devoted to regional jealousies. Shortly after the worst of the Sky Dark was over, some descendants of the original survivors decided they had outlasted the aftermath of global devastation for a reason. These families of survivors knew people would revert to primitive levels, so they determined to force some sort of order on barbarism. They were better educated, better bred, and better armed than almost anyone else who shambled across the Deathlands. The families became ruling hierarchies, and they spread out across the ruined face of America. The territories they conquered became baronies. At first, people retreated into the vills ruled by the barons for protection. Then, as the decades went by, they remained because they had no choice. Generations of Americans were born into serfdom, slavery in everything but name. The 22nd century edged toward the 23rd. Many of the most powerful, most enduring baronies evolved into city-states, walled fortresses whose influence stretched across the Deathlands for hundreds of miles. In decades past, the barons had warred against one another. Then they realized, or were taught, that greater rewards were possible if unity was achieved. territories were redefined, treaties struck among the barons, and the city-states became interconnected points in a continent-spanning network. A program of unification was ratified and ruthlessly employed. The reconstructed form of government was still basically despotic, but now it was institutionalized and shared by all the former independent baronies. 9 baronies survived. Control of the continent was divided among the 9 barons. The pretenders, those who were not part of the original hierarchy, but who arrogantly assumed the title to carve out their own little pieces of empire, were overrun, exterminated, and their territories absorbed. The hierarchical ruling system remained, and the city-states adopted the name of the titular heads of state. Technology, most of it based on pre-Dark designs, appeared mysteriously and simultaneously with the beginning of the unification program. Many previously unknown stockpiles were opened up and their contents distributed evenly among the barons. Though the technologies were restricted for the use of those who held the reins of power, life overall improved for the citizens in and around the Vills. Manufacturing industries, totally under the control of the Vills, began again. That was the history Lakesh had told them. He had implied that agents of the Archons had been the true architects of much of that history, pulling the strings to trigger coups, wars, and the overall destabilization of the entire world. Moreover, due to Operation Kronos, the power elite knew exactly what would happen and when, and had taken no measures to stop it. That was the history they knew. Except now, none of it appeared to be true.